Officials found out
that six.
The party which was guilty of most of these reprisals, about 99%, was the American-supported Ngo Ding-ziem government. And so, to answer your question, I don't think that there... I think if the United States left Vietnam, the people of Vietnam would be able to get together and decide their fate, their destiny. And that is the only thing that we can. I'd like to add another thing, is that many of us Vietnamese are concerned that people in the peace movement are, some groups in the peace movement are playing power politics now, are supporting this faction and that faction in Vietnam. If you are against the Vietnam War, if you are against American involvement there, if you support one faction or other, it would be just as bad as Nixon's support of the Tioki government. The only role the American people have in Vietnam is to demand the withdrawal of United States force there. What we do in Vietnam, we Vietnamese have to decide. You mean our war against the French?
Well, the reasons for the whole thing starting, if it can be.
Our war against the French began ever since the French moved into Vietnam. We've been having a war for liberation. When the French, during the Second World War, the French cooperated with the Japanese, and the Vietnamese were the only, Viet Minh were the only people in Vietnam who are fighting both the Japanese and the French and with the support of the Allies. And afterwards, the French, I don't know whether I should go into the whole history here, but the fight in Vietnam is very obviously the fight against foreign interference, foreign powers dictating to Vietnamese people what Vietnam should do. It's also a fight for equality, social equality in Vietnam. You see, before when the French were there, there were, in the South especially, there were very few rich people, rich landowners owning huge plantations, and large numbers of poor peasants who owned no land, owed lots of money because of the way the debt system was functioning in Vietnam at that time. And so our fight for liberation is not only for national liberation, but for social liberation, for a country where all Vietnamese can have equal opportunity, equal land, equal food, and a Vietnam that is not, as now, being bombed by American bombs, suffering under defoliation, and so forth. Does that explain your question? Yes?
I've seen some analysis where in the past number of months the shift, the movement of people into urbanization in sort of areas has increased very rapidly. And in fact, some say this is the real reason for the Laos invasion. And one should not just say, well, the Arvon troops were defeated and therefore the objectives were not realized. In fact, they might have been realized when the figures finally come out in terms of people move from the bullet zone 3 down closer to Saigon. Are you saying that there is no negative effect, or are you saying this is completely backfired?
Because you're right. The situation if I understand you correctly, the situation in the urban area is a big crisis now. As I said, the government cannot control the resentment, the anger, you know, the anti-war movement, anti-United States involvement movement there. And so that urbanization plan has backfired. Yeah?
What is the draft age? What happens if a guy refuses to go into the service?
He is thrown in prison, tortured, or killed. There's cases of International Control Commission officers going to villages near Cambodia, and the villagers explained there that Arvon troops would come in, would point out all the young men to conscript into the army, and if anyone showed a sign of hesitation at that moment, he would be shot. Now, in Saigon itself, conscription is forcible. And in fact, the high school students now, in the you see, if you pass certain examinations, then you can have what you have in the United States now. What do you call it? What?
Deferment.
Yeah, a deferment. And what's happened is that to have more people conscripted, about 90% of the students in the high schools have failed their examinations. And these examinations are not difficult. So that's another way in which people are conscripted in Vietnam. Yeah?
From my limited experience working with the South Vietnamese infantry, I found that the Manyoris were treated as an inferior race, and that they virtually held no positions of power either within the army or the government throughout all South Vietnam. Do you know what the relationship is between the Manyoris and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam government, between the People's Army of Vietnam and the Manyoris?
Yes, you are right that the Montagnards are very badly, given the kind of status that I think Afro-Americans in this country are given and are discriminated against in the pocket army of Vietnam. However, in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and in the National Liberation Front, Montagnards are represented. And in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, in the education, the Montagnards are first taught their own language, because the language of many Montagnard tribes are not the language of the plain-dwelling Vietnamese. They must first learn their language, and then they learn Vietnamese. They are allowed to keep their culture. Their culture is respected, and at the same time, if they wish to be assimilated, they are welcomed into the government of Vietnam, in the people of Vietnam. Yes, there are. I don't remember exactly the names now. There are Montagnards represented in almost every branch of the government. There are some. The majority of the people living in Vietnam are Vietnamese nationality. The Montagnards are minority group. But what I'm saying is that minority is being represented. Yeah?
Do you think the United States will give up its war while the United States economy is controlled by capitalists?
I think if the American people have forced the United States government to, they can. It is true that what has happened in Vietnam is largely a result of continuation of United States capitalist policy abroad, which is called by many people imperialism. That is true. I don't think you need to wait until a revolution in this country, though, to end the war in Vietnam. Yeah?
How encouraged are the Indochinese people by the opposition to the war by the American people?
Well, I don't think that, you know, our successes in Vietnam is entirely due to the actions of the peace movement in this country. However, it's made us become aware of many things. First of all, the most important thing, that we are not at war with the government of the United States. And the peace movement has shown us this. The peace movement has shown us that the Americans were our friends, and that we have to look elsewhere in the seats of the White House for our enemy. And so, the peace movement helps us understand, you know, the relationship between the peoples of the world. And it has helped our morale, as it were. But in terms of, like, actual fighting, it is still up to us. Yeah?
You obviously have some channels of information that we don't have, and you want to hear. I wonder if there's some way that you're asking information to be disseminated.
there are several channels that you still have in this country. One of them is through Wilfred Burchett's articles in The Guardian, which are very accurate. There's another organization in Canada of Vietnamese patriots. I will give you their names now. They publish every other month a magazine called Dien Phang, which is avant-garde, which gives you the news of the Vietnamese people, and it's written by Vietnamese. And if you have pencil and paper, I will give you the address now. It's Post Office Box 324, Station N, Montreal 129, Quebec, Canada. And if you want to, sorry? Yeah, it's Tien Phong, T-I-E-N, Phong, P-H-O-N-G, Post Office Box 324, Station N, Montreal 129, Quebec, Canada. That's the best source of information you have. If you have any questions, you can write to that group. Yeah.
And you know, in this country, one of the big movements now is the women's liberation movement. But when you look at the newspapers, it seems as if a great part of the provisional revolutionary government, the chief negotiator for Paris peace talks and so on, are Vietnamese women. Has Vietnamese society come to grips with this issue years and years ago? Or
well, the oppression of women is related to the oppression of Asians, Afro-Americans, and so forth. And it is the result of a system of a capitalist system, to put it the most bluntly. And in Vietnam too, in traditional Vietnam, and in Vietnam of Thieu and Ky, the situation of women is also very poor, very weak. You don't see too many women in the government of Thieu and Ky. However, since we have had our revolution in Vietnam, and in the struggle in the South now, the situation of women has to be entirely changed, because our structure, our society is entirely changed. We are looking at the world, and we are living in a world with new eyes now. So that, yes, until very recently, as early as 1945, in Vietnam, the situation of women was that of an oppressed class. But now it is not, because people realize that to have equality means not just equality among men, but equality between men and women too. In fact, there's a statement in traditional Vietnam a long time ago that says that one son is worth more than 10 daughters, and that is not the case now in the North. In the North, if you ever see any of the films coming from the North, there are many heroic women fighters in the artillery brigades. Women carry a very important part of the struggle in Vietnam now. Is there no more questions? And that's all.
Our next panel will be the panel on racism with commentary by Dr. Napoleon N. Vaughn, PhD in psychology and private practice here in Philadelphia.
Thank you. Richard Shepherd. I'm 24. I served in the Marine Corps in 68 to 70. I was stationed in Da Nang area. My tour in Vietnam, and I was with 7th Engineer Battalion.
Good. My name's Tim Heglin. I'm 21 years old. I'm a Philadelphia resident. I served in Vietnam from August of 68 to August of 69. I was assigned to the 1st Logistics Command, assigned to the 4th Division. My MOS was Graves Registration.
I'm Napoleon Vaughn, psychologist here in Philadelphia.
My name is Mike Mishashik. I was E-4 with the 101st Airborne. I'm 22 years old, and I'm presently unemployed.
My name is Johnny Hatch. I was an E-4 in Vietnam, stationed at Fire Base Nancy in Quang Tri, Vietnam.
As you've already been told, this panel is involved with racism. And through our experience in the military, it has been proven to us that racism is being used as a tool in order to keep the military personnel in line and keep them psyched up to go in and participate in these activities that have been going down. One very straight thing coming out from here, as far as the black personnel going into the Marine Corps, by losing his identity, first he is classified as a SPLIB. And my whole tour in the military, this is what I was classified as from the ranking officers, from sergeants on up. And as far as the discharges and whatnot, Tim, relate on that.
The discharges?
Yeah.
I don't understand what you mean.
The offer given of how they hold discharges as, you know, to keep you in line.
Yeah, well, what basically happens is that you know, they threaten you with discharges all the time. You know, like, you'll do a tour, and you'll get maybe most of your tour done, or you'll be about to ETS or rotate, and then they threaten you with a discharge. You know, you've put up with all their bullshit for maybe, like, 34 months. You have 2 months left in the service or something like that. And what happens is they start, you know, you better stay in line, kid, because if you don't, what's going to happen to you is you're going to get offed, you know. And then you're going to lose a lot of the benefits that you would get normally if you had an honorable discharge or, an honorable separation from the service. So they threaten you. They have different ways of threatening you with things, you know, different ways of making sure people don't get together, you know, different methods, you know. They'll give you bad assignments, you know. They'll put you in a tougher position, things like this, you know. They control you. That's basically what it's about.
I'd just like to testify on the use of racism to further military careers of the higher echelon officers. For a while, I was working in a headquarters directly under a colonel and a lieutenant colonel. And this lieutenant colonel prided himself with trying to hang the black guys. As soon as they had an afro, he saw to it that the company commander gave them all kinds of dirty details and put them under extra pressure until they broke. Either they'd resort to physical violence or just abusive language to an officer. And now they had him. What they do is, well, they'd give him a court martial and bust him, maybe send him away. Now, what happened 1 month was the prosecuting attorney, DeRose, he went home. And this lieutenant colonel didn't have anybody to prosecute his black boys for him. And he was sending down to where the newcomers just came into country, checking for a lawyer. He wanted one bad. Well, after about 2 weeks waiting, he finally got word that one was on his way. He was all hepped up. They're going to start the hanging again. Well, the new lawyer arrives, and son of a gun, if he isn't a black man himself. So he just sends him back where he came from, says he can't use him. That's all I have to say.
Well, the thing I have to say about discharges in the Army, I have served 35 months in the Army, and they pulled me out of Vietnam for a compassionate reassignment and put me right in the stockade from the mental hospital. And then they gave me a discharge for unsuitability after 35 months in the Army. And, you know, like, it's prejudice between the whites and the blacks. If a black is hanging with a white, they want to burn both of them. And if they can't get one, they'll get the other. and, you know, like it's really a hassle about it.
I'm sure many of you saw the selling of the Pentagon on television through the week. And, like, if you notice in that picture, there was a set where they showed Vietnamese POWs playing soccer. Well, right behind that part where they were playing soccer is the United States prisoners, American prisoners that refused to go out into the field or were busted for not saying sir to an officer or other mediocre charges like this, and they were put into confinement. In that brig, there are at least 65% of those prisoners are blacks. And half of them, after serving over their tour, or about, 7 or 8 months of their time in Vietnam, probably are let out of this brig and given BCDs or UDs and sent back to the United States. And when they come back to the United States, they have very little to look forward to after going through changes like this. And also, in Da Nang, in February of 69, there was a riot, and several people were hurt during this riot. It was also during the time when they were rioting in Camp Lejeune and also Camp Pendleton. There are several racial riots happening within the Marine Corps. I'm not too sure about the Army because I wasn't in there, but Tim, you...
Well, there was also a race riot at Quignon. I believe it was about a month after I came back, they had a race riot in Quignon. I'd like to bring up the point right now that it seems that a lot of times, well, the Army is a white established thing. The Army is run by white people. And it seems that many times the whites try to work a thing with, like, the, you know, turn the Orientals against the black and so forth. I know many times you'd be, like, in Saigon, and you'd be picked up by a Vietnamese cab driver, and you'd be going down the street, and the black person would be, you know, walking down the street, and he'd say, see black person, him same monkey. Now, like, Vietnamese, is like, their culture, they're very basically humble people. They're not very outspoken. So they wouldn't, well, first of all, they wouldn't think of something like that themselves. Someone had to put that there, you know? And then secondly, they just wouldn't come out and say that to a white man unless they thought that the majority of the white people there felt like that. You know, that's a pretty outspoken thing for a Vietnamese person to say. So they have a general opinion that, like, you know, it's a form of amusement, I guess, for many white people to tell Vietnamese that blacks are monkeys and things like this. And I also noticed that in many times blacks, they're given a lot of jobs in the service. The majority of blacks are given jobs in the service that things they can't do on the outside, you know, menial jobs in the service that they can't use on the outside. Many times jobs that are very dangerous. You see many more blacks in the field than you do in base camps. Many more blacks in artillery and in infantry instead of as a clerk typist or in signal corps, things like this. So it's, you know, they're getting screwed.
There's nothing really in the military that blacks can identify themselves to and say, well, wow, this is my place right here, so therefore I can relate to this and I'm here. Because everything in the military, like, they even run it on a racist thing, whereas you have to use the terminology sir to every officer or NCO, and you aren't allowed to look this person in the eye when you're talking to them. You have to look straight forward, and by doing this, the officer automatically has the upper hand, and if you talk to him on the level where you are, then you are considered disrespectful. And as the black GI going through a thing like this, and then coming back to the world, or coming back to the United States, and all he has to identify himself with is the Black Panther Party or Elijah Muhammad or things of this nature, because in the military, you're separated, really, because you want to stay away from these whites as much as possible, because of the treatment that you're giving in there, and you know that none of them can do anything for you. And the same thing is happening when you come out here. You see the same thing. And Dr. Vaughn has had several encounters with black GIs having all types of different problems. And you speak on that, Doctor?
Okay. I think one of the things we should consider, first of all, is some of the background. From those who've spoken thus far, you get a pretty good idea, or at least of some of the surface things, or some of the more obvious factors that we see. But behind all of this, let's take a look. If you look at it this way, we would tend to think, admittedly, that for black people, the army tends to be some sort of salvation, in quotes. Now, that's an interesting statement, because what has happened is that black men, unlike white men, has used the army as their college. When a white male decides that pressure at home has become too great, that he wants to get away from mama legitimately, and he wants to make certain that mama can accept this very readily, he goes off to college. And there at college, he pursues the white Protestant ethic and then makes good. Unfortunately, black men do not have this opportunity because of the educational system itself, because of de facto segregated education systems, and because the education system for them basically is not good. What the black youngster does as a means of ridding himself of an oppressive society, particularly gang warfare and other types of confrontations that he can't do battle with, decides inadvertently that he goes off voluntarily into the army. The army serves as another purpose too, because the army turns out to be that place for the individual young man who does not have enough smarts to make it onto the college scene, but just enough smarts to get through the armed forces qualification test, which requires the equivalency of a fourth grade education. So that reason, you have a tremendous amount of black young men escaping the ghetto. They're trying to escape the bed bugs and the roaches, the prostitution and the drugs, the gang warfare, and what have you. So for them, they find the army as a place of salvation. Salvation in this sense, they feel for the first time they can get their teeth fixed. For the first time, they can have some of the medical care that they weren't able to get before. For the first time, they find that they can get training, which they couldn't get before vocationally. But they don't realize at the moment that the training is at the cost of their sacrificing their lives, in the sense that they end up in Vietnam waking up one morning dead. Tragic, too, about all of this is that when the GI gets there, he has had certain visions in his mind as the army, at least, as being a subculture of a culture where there's absolute freedom. The interesting thing also is that what the GI, the one who's black, has learned how to do more than anything else is learn how to kill. He's been trained to be a professional killer, so much a month he gets for being successful. And if he's very successful, he's rewarded with badges that he can put across his heart, or there are things he can put on his arms. And if he's really great at it, he can put little shiny things up on his shoulders. The thing that does not happen is that once the black GI finds out that the war he's fighting is not really his war, it's a tremendously unpopular war for both whites and blacks, but it's extremely more unpopular for blacks, who in turn get shares of the rhetoric that they can hear in terms of black power, black awareness, and black self-consciousness. And with the ability of learning how to kill and having been rewarded by their company commander for being successful at killing, and because they are rewarded for doing this, it is very difficult for them to turn this off when they've come back home. Interestingly enough, Vietnam is supposed to be the only war after World War I, World War II, and Korea that the black soldier is supposed to prove himself. But the proving is in the sense of killing, and there is no debriefing. The black soldier is brought back. He understands that this battle really hasn't been his battle. He's fighting someone else's battle, and he thinks that his battle is the battle which is going to rectify the ills that have been perpetuated within the ghetto. He has built in a hell of a lot of frustration. With this frustration, it is suppressed and pushed in the background, and that he has already tasted the joy, quotes, of killing. He's already been rewarded for doing this. And since he's not going to be a cop when he comes back, his skills aren't really needed until such time as he explodes again. not too long ago, here in Philadelphia, a young man who was in Vietnam in the service, who's black, discovered that someone else here had caused the relationship between him and his wife to break up. He went to confront this other man, who's also black, and found out that he was not there. He found his 4-year-old daughter in the bathtub and has found his wife at home. What he did, as a result of the tremendous frustration that he felt internally, which he had repressed and suppressed for so long, he ended up slitting the throat of the wife and drowning the baby in the bathtub. He apparently knew something was wrong with him, because what he did immediately after this was turn himself into one of the hospitals to a psychiatrist. I think the difficulty about what Vietnam is doing for the black veteran, in terms of the black style of the veteran anyway, who is not inclined to suppress and internalize with psychosomatic illness of migraine headaches and peptic ulcers and duodenal ulcers and low back pains and constipation and diarrhea and what have you, he tends to act out more. And for that reason, Vietnam, which is triggering it, is doing something that hasn't happened before. In the sense, it's almost given us a license to go ahead and become violent, because we operate basically in a six-shooter society anyway.
So it's really just a dehumanizing process. And I feel this dehumanization within myself, just as the doctor has experienced it through his other patients. And the brother on the end here has experienced it probably greater than I have, because the type of discharge that they dropped on him when he got out as far as getting employment. There are all kinds of jobs out here offered to Vietnam veterans, you know, like grave diggers and working in a theater is ushers and things of this nature, which gives you no place to relieve all this frustration, because when you relate these incidences to these people, they don't want to hear it, because you're just competing with the press. You're competing with TV and the radio, and this is what people seem to be eating before they would listen to the truth. And the fact is that we have to move on from here. And I have something I'd like to read from the Third World. It says, the fact is that the total U.S. casualties in Southeast Asia, almost half are Spanish surnamed and Afro-American. The figures are 8,500 and 12,000 respectively. This is graphic proof of activity against the war is not a white thing.
Is there anything to wrap to? Just speaking basically about what happens in the service, I know of certain instances that have happened to me, where a group of whites will just say, okay, man, screw it. Let's get together with some people, man. Let's get together with blacks. And you'll begin, like, hanging around with blacks. And the next thing you know, like, sergeants, like when they walk by, officers walk by, they give you a little bit of a snare, first of all. You know, they just kind of look at you, you know. And then after a while, it grows into a little bigger thing, and they start walking up, and they start saying things like, hey, you know, you're going to get in trouble if you keep on hanging around with the people you're hanging around with, because I think they're a bad influence on you. And it just progresses more and more like that. And a lot of times the attitudes, I've seen sergeants really support, like white dudes will come to the NOM, right? And the sergeants in the outfit will really, you know, clan them up, man, hunkify them. You know, they'll play around with them. Like I remember one instance when I was in Play Coup, there was a white dude and a black dude. The black dude was young. He was only about 18 years old. He just turned 18 and they sent him to the NOM. And the white dude was chasing him with a snake. It was a dead snake, you know? And he chased him out the door. And the kid was scared of snakes, right? That's, you know what I mean? Like, you know, snakes freaked him out. So it pissed me off. So I grabbed a snake, you know, and like the sergeant was standing there and he was laughing. He thought it was really funny, you know? So I grabbed the snake off the white dude and I shoved it in his face. I go, you like somebody shoving snakes in your face? And as soon as I did it, the sergeant said, oh, wait a minute now. It was just a little bit of, you know, he thought it was funny when it was happening to the black dude. But when I did it to the white dude, he started getting all, you know, take it easy. Don't get too excited about it, you know? And finally what happened is like I heard, you know, the sergeant would talk to the new white dudes coming into this, you know, into the unit, and he'd start, you know, just really unlogical racism, you know, like that's something else. Like he was a racist, but his racism wasn't a very sound thing. Like the majority of white people that seem to be racist have a very unrealistic view on racism. Like they tell you, don't bite the sandwich off a black dude because all black dudes have SIFT. You know, like really stupid. They bite their toenails. You know. Like really stupid things, man. But the majority of black people that I've seen that are bitter, you know, their racism is at least logical. You know, they have sound reasons why they are, you know, a racist, you know. And also I've noticed that it's much easier for a white person like to show friendship for a black person and have it be accepted, you know, and embraced than for a black person to show friendship towards a white person and have it be embraced, you know, like a white dude can, if he's willing, be accepted by blacks far easier than a black person can be accepted by whites, even though they're both equally sincere. So it's kind of a strange thing. Man.
Another aspect of this tragic part of it, particularly for the black soldier, is that black people currently constitute approximately 11% of the total population. But at one time in Vietnam, blacks, although 11% of the total population, constituted 25% of the fatal casualties in Vietnam. And the reason for that were partly the fault also of the black soldier himself. There's been a tremendous need on the part of black people to prove themselves. And there's been a tremendous need on the part of black men to prove their masculinity. There's no better way to do this than to show how strong you are or show how well you can fight or how brave you are. Paratroopers, frontline runners, the incidence of deaths among black soldiers was so great that the Pentagon at one time had to call a moratorium on sending black soldiers to the front line who had this fantastic need to prove that they were capable. Many of the blacks coming back has said that one of the reasons why they went into the army in the first place was because they couldn't get a job, was because they couldn't get a decent education. And now coming back, they're facing the same problem. When they left, they thought the situation would change before they got back. In Newark, New Jersey, at Western Electric, a number of the blacks there have said, to get into Western Electric, we threw a brick to get in. And this has resulted, of course, in the riots that occurred in Newark and Detroit and Watts, Washington, D.C. Now they're finding out that when they come back, the situation for which they joined the army in the first place hasn't altered any. And they're reaching the idea that perhaps if we threw a brick to get in there in the first place, maybe we'll have to throw a brick to get in there today as we did some years ago. The tragic aspect of Vietnam, different, of course, from World War II, and different, of course, from Korea, is that Vietnam is a guerrilla war. It is a small arms war. It is not tanks running across the battle lines. It is not bazookas and big field guns shooting. It is a hand-to-hand combat. What many veterans have now learned is how to take homemade compounds and destroy, how to take commercial compounds and destroy, how to really hit and run like the American Indians did in the type of guerrilla warfare that's being fought in Vietnam. The danger of all of this is, as the movie Ocean's 11 showed us, is what can happen when a number of veterans get back and decide, instead of knocking off a casino that's a gambling joint, what happens when veterans get back and decide in their own little march that they're going to do something against the system, something that we haven't even seen yet, a Holocaust much more awful than anything that we have seen to date.
And some of the few experiences that I've had in the Army was, I was hospitalized for 4 months with a cerebral hemorrhage of the brain, which almost died. And I was put in a mental institution for a month, you know, because, you know, like my emotions were so mixed up. And I had a white major pull me out of there saying there was nothing wrong with me. And he sent me straight to Vietnam to commit atrocities just like My Lai or something else. Right out of a mental institution. And see, these are the things that Army thrives on, prejudice and stuff like this.
On every American military base, regardless to where, there is a ghetto. In Vietnam, you got the dog patch. In Okinawa, you got the Four Corners. In the world, in the United States, you always have this section. It's always sectioned off. It's always a separate thing. And the further you go into it, wherever you go, it's always, you're always separated. You're always separate. And once you are together, either the black is down by his own, called the Tom, or the white is down by his own, called a nigger lover, which is a very common thing. And the only way you can deal with this is to get the mass of you together, and this togetherness only comes under extreme pressure. I found this out myself through being in the bush, when that's when I really could relate to white guys, other than just being white guys, but being, wow, human just like me.
Right on, brother, man.
And the dehumanizing processes that they were going through, you know, in the rear, it was just mainly the NCOs and the officers that were really content as long as this separation, as long as all this static was going down. They were happy. They were really happy. And I would like some the audience to have any questions. You shoot out. Yeah.
When I was in Vietnam, we had a race riot right on my base. And the reason why we had a race riot was mostly because of the war machine. I meant the military machine. It was like instead of sending a white guy out on patrol, for instance, they'd send a black man, which isn't right. And actually, when it comes down to it all, it's just that a lot of them lifers or career men are prejudiced. And they actually cause the race riots, which go on. And they dig it, you know? They like it.
Well, the majority of these officers and these higher rankers, they're Southerners. They're stone rednecks.
Dig it. Thank you. Thank you.
Cornbread.
I'd like to ask you, when was the father finally diagnosed? How long after your renown was it diagnosed?
It was diagnosed while I was in the hospital. Last September. September of 1969.
Before they sent?
Right.
Wow. And what happened when you were in Nam?
Well, like I went through a lot of mental stress and, you know, and so they had me seeing a psychiatrist every week, you know, and I was in a major combat zone at the time on a fire base, and I was the only one running around without a weapon for 3 months.
Yeah, they have several conscientious objectors in Vietnam running around in the so-called pacified areas without weapons, but they have the flight jackets, but they aren't issued any weapons.
Yeah. Well, see, I was. They took my weapon away from me without defending myself, and yet and still they were sending mortars and rockets on us. You know, and I didn't have nothing to defend myself with.
I was an officer in the Marine Corps, and we understood the problem was really big with racism. And it was due to the fact that most of the lifers were from the South, like a lot of your NCOs. But like you said, the majority of the officers, like I'd say about 50% of them really didn't care as long as they weren't hassled from their company commanders. I'm talking about lieutenants and platoon commanders. But the thing was that the only reason, or the only way you could deal with this problem was if you knew who your NCOs were, like your first sergeant, your gunny sergeant, and people like this were usually lifers in the Corps, and they just believed
any sound?
I wouldn't say the majority of them. I'd say about 50% that would, the ones that I knew were really concerned about this problem, because this was one of, I'm talking about garrison duty, because it was Camp Lejeune, Camp Pendleton, all these places, it was going on, and it was our job to go out and find out. I don't see how anybody who was a platoon commander who could look at his troops and distinguish somebody because they were black, they were white, or yellow. There's no way he can do his job right. But there is like 50% that weren't even concerned about that. They were concerned about getting their medals and like low rank and the officer's rank. You made first lieutenant, you made captain. It came, you know, no matter what. You know, you really, if you served, if you put in so many years, you get your rank. But these NCOs were held down. They had to get a good efficiency report or they didn't get promoted, these lifers, like the whole thing. And like at Camp Lejeune, the riot down there, they had, it was about 2 years ago, it was a big riot down there. And it was, there was one white person killed. And it should have never happened. It was due, I believe, to the NCOs, who are career men in the service and who are really racist.
And then when the riots and whatnot start breaking out, and then he start giving the blacks permission to wear afros, right? Well, we'll give them a play. We'll let them wear afros and throw the power, you know, maybe they'll lighten up a little bit. See, we're out of the war now. We're out of the military, and we're out here in civilians, right? And we have experienced all of this. I mean, all of this extreme racism has been thrown in has been, you know, is in us now, right? And so now we're out here dealing with supposedly normal people. And like, I have no conversation for anyone, you know, for these people that I'm trying to deal with right now. You know, I don't know what to say or even how to act around them, you know, because of the changes they put me through in the military. So, and drawing a conclusion, man, I mean, where do we go from here, you know?
Question, like, who, you know, like, I'm beyond talking about it. Like, I just got out, and I've been in the same boat looking for a job. Do you have experience? I say, yeah, I got a college degree. You know, I'm a demolition and weapons expert. It's the same thing. You know, like, where do you go?
You got to think and see, like, the service, like, really plays around with your head. The service has a big effect on your personality and so forth, right? Now, they don't give you any, when you're in the service, right, they don't give you anything. Like, if they spend as much time giving you films and talks on black history or how to relate to people and things like that as they did on how to kill people, you know, the service is just racist, and it's very, because you have one person that has three stripes on his arm and he's better than the other person that has two stripes on his arm, you have a racist thing. And they handle things as racist. And what makes it really bad is it's a white military racism. So they just play over your mind, man. Like, they don't give you anything to do. They want to keep people separated. They don't care if people get together. They just want you to be a killer, you know?
I found out about the military was, like, you really don't really realize this until you get out and you look back on it. You start doing a lot of thinking about it. Like, somebody who hasn't experienced it,
okay,
they're not really concerned.
Okay, I realized that while I was in there. I was in there for 2.5 years, and I was a PFC my whole time in the military. Never put up for a promotion. When I got out of Vietnam and came back to the world, I was stationed in Norfolk, Virginia, and locked up in the brig there for not saying sir to an officer, you know? They threw me in the brig before my trial and said I was contemptuous to his command, you know? Because I was supposed to be a militant, you know, that terminology was really, you know, boss, you know, he's a militant. So they locked me up in solitary confinement for 2 weeks before my trial, right? And so because I was conscious of what was happening all my time in there, and there are many other black people in there that know this before they get out, because they have experienced things of similarities before they went in. And so in dealing with something, you know, like this, that's what we have to get into from here, you know, like, okay, we've been through it and we're out of it, but there's so many more going through it, man, that it's pathetic.
It's the same thing as being loved for being ignorant but hated for being militant.
That's Dr. Vaughn's question. I just got out of the Navy recently, and I found that there were not a large number, but quite a few blacks and lifers in the military who tended to co-opt genuine relationships between whites and blacks in the military. And is there any specific reason why there are people like this who do, you know, who have sold out and who are going over to the other side and who are taking their part?
Well, that's not new. You can find almost going back from the slavery days of the field hands and the house niggers. They've always been around, and they're going to be around again. We'll find it that some of them are even, some of the black ward leaders are back in Rizzo. It's the haves against the have-nots, and if you have it, you don't want to lose it, and if you got a little bit of it, get more of it, and continue to get more of it until you can get it all, but you never get it all, so you continue trying. If you don't get it, you get frustrated.
It seems like the service seems to let, like a lot of white dudes that go in, the service seems to do one or the other. Like, you're exposed to black people, right? For the first time, like living together, eating together, and things like that. If you're from a place like Georgia, a lot of times what it does is really make you super right wing. You know what I mean? Like, you're exposed to black people. You've been raised, like, the people that are really, like, the white dudes that are really, like, racist, they have a general idea where you're supposed to tolerate blacks. That's the patriotic thing. You're with them, so you tolerate them. A lot of other white dudes just say, okay, here we are, man. They rap to black dudes. They say, I like some of them. I don't like some of them. You know what I mean? They're individuals just like everybody else. So as a result, you just have a tendency to integrate. But like, a lot of white sergeants that are racist, man, play a big influence on a lot of young white dudes that come in, man. They actually organize. They organize clans on the base. They do things like that. And, you know, it throws you one way or the other a lot of times. The service has a tendency to make you really a racist or... you know, really into it, man. Just say, okay, let's get it down.
The way I've seen it is the difficulty does not arise so much near the front lines where a bullet is coming and you don't know whether it's your name or somebody else's name on it and it's going to be delivered. At that point, racism just about is out the window. Where it tends to peak its ugly head again is in that vast waiting period where you have a chance through idolism to get involved in some things that you didn't want to get involved in before or couldn't, including your own head. It is getting involved in one's own head and the waiting that has caused one of the vast drug problems. The drug problem is also there because you think if you can't face it as a man, you can face it while high. So that's one of the reasons why there's such a high incidence of drugs, and the drugs are being brought back here. Together with another problem, which is much more difficult perhaps even than the drugs, and that is venereal disease. A strand of venereal disease that has come back, unlike anything that we've ever worked with before. Now, in California at least, there's an epidemic throughout the state. Penicillin doesn't seem to work on this strand of ED the way it has worked on others. And it is not only gonorrhea, it's chancroid. So all of these problems are additional problems which have come back. And many men don't get a complete shakedown before they come back to this country. Some of them don't even know they have it. Some of them know they do have it, and they bring it back wholesale. So the additional problem is this aspect of it. For instance, in San Francisco, they have discovered, and this is Newsweek, if you want to take a look at it, they have discovered that in San Francisco, one patient every three at the San Francisco clinic is there for a drug problem.
I'd like to just say one thing on that. Like, when you're in the Army, what happens when you get drafted, you're forced together with a whole bunch of guys, and you get to know them. You don't even have time to look at what skin they got. You're together with them, you're facing the same problems, you're getting the same harassment, usually. And I think if anything's going to overcome racism, it's people together.
The way I figured, we were the unwilling, led by the unqualified, forced to do the unnecessary for the ungrateful.
I have a question for the doctor. Have you seen like a lot of cases where like a black GI goes to Vietnam and what he's more or less doing, what he is doing, is fighting a racist war for white people, and when he comes back, he becomes aware of the fact that as a black man who is oppressed, you know. He's oppressed a yellow man. And have you seen any like psychological complications?
Yeah, this is the thing that's somewhat tragic for a lot of them, is because the damage of Vietnam does not hit some GIs right away. It hits them later until they begin to wake up to the thing that has happened to them and what they've gone through. When we were on the Jim Blocker show, do you remember?
Yeah.
One fella said that after he shot his first man, after he saw this human being turn over and he knew that he'd blown part of his guts out, he threw his rifle down and couldn't pick up a rifle again the whole time he was in Vietnam. There's also the other extremity of the guy who did the first killing and felt a fantastic power that was in his hands as a result of all the shooting. And he could feel with a machine gun how hot the machine gun chassis became and how this fantastic strength and psychic energy, almost like a sexual thing, got him all wrapped up. When he gets back, this is still here. The only thing it takes is something to trigger that off. Now, we don't know what's going to trigger it off. It could take the least little thing, or it could take something more magnified. But what has occurred is that a number of the black GIs feel a great deal of guilt for what they've done, in the sense that they have pursuing their own ends of going into the service to escape. When they've come back and found out that they haven't really escaped, is all here, and then they're madder than ever before. What has happened is that a lot of them has turned this hatred on themselves, and they've turned this hatred on to other black people. And as you see, if you look at even Nightlife, one of the bar sheets, Charles Searles has come out for Rizzo. And what a lot of other people have done is come out for Rizzo because they've recognized that black people have turned the hatred on other black people rather than turn it on the society itself, and they've gotten tremendously hung up and confused, and that is the story of the problem.
And then wrapping it up, since I've been associating with the VVAW, like there are very few black brothers that want to come down, you know, even though they've experienced the same thing that these white cats have experienced, they don't want to come down and relate. I mean, and get down and put this thing out to the people and correct it, because it's very incorrect. They just don't even want to relate, you know.
They have problems that are a little bit more immediate. I'd also like to say just one thing, and it's a little bit foolish for America to say that they're in Vietnam freeing people when it's very, you know, evident that there's people that are serving in Vietnam that aren't free. You know, that's kind of jive. You know, it just doesn't make sense.
The only thing I can really say is the world today is in a very difficult situation. You know it, and I know it. But what we don't know is who's going to take the blame.
A couple of things. One, obviously we're concerned about the small turnout, but we are taping this. We will use these tapes. We feel they will be valuable. Two, I want to be sure those of you that are veterans here know about Dewey Canyon 3. I just put a simple question. Is there anybody here as a Vietnam vet who doesn't know about Dewey Canyon 3? You don't.
No, is there any transportation available from Philadelphia?
Okay. Yeah. Dewey Canyon, we're attempting to get 5,000 Vietnam veterans in fatigue uniforms to Washington on April 18th, that's a Sunday night, to meet at George Washington University campus on the athletic fields. You will be, if you go, we'd like you in fatigues. If you can't, okay, you can't. With sleeping bags. We will get buses. Right now we're attempting to get enough bread locally, and if not locally, nationally, to provide buses to take people to Washington. My guess is that from Philadelphia we'll be able to arrange this locally. Certainly, those of you here can help us with, you know, the publicity and getting organized, sending out letters, and all the rest. The way you can help is you can talk to John Birch or Joe Bangard or any of the other people at 928 Chestnut. If you can, we urge you, give them all the help you can. Sometimes there won't be anything that they'll have for you to do. Many times they will. If nothing else, we can send you out in the street and get you to get donations. Okay, that's... in terms of the... are there any other questions about Dewey Canyon 3? About what we're doing, the procedure? We will provide transportation or arrange it. Any other questions about it? Right, Art. It's on its way. The raw film will give you a good idea of what we're talking about. Those of you who were there will recall it was a pretty dramatic experience for all of us, and I think we did have some impact. We're just going to try to multiply that thing by 50. We started out that raw march with about 80 people. We ended with about 250 vets. Sadly, the other people that are going to Washington with us are mothers, or rather parents and wives of active duty GIs in Indochina, parents and wives of people, of GIs who were killed in Indochina, and parents and wives of prisoners in North Vietnam. Okay, now the next thing we're going to have here is a film. This is an excellent film. It's called The Evil Hour. It's by the Committee of Responsibility. And there'll be some comments about introducing the film by Dr. Herb Needleman, who's a psychiatrist, who's the chairman of the Committee of Responsibility, which is a national organization of physicians who bring wounded Vietnamese to the United States for extensive medical care. Herb will introduce the film, which is about 20 minutes. Committee of Responsibility for a long time did not want to show this because they were